Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. High blood pressure, also known as hypertension, is sometimes called the silent killer. About 1 in 3 Americans have high blood pressure, but only about half have their blood pressure under control. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Julie McCormick to discuss what hypertension is, how it's diagnosed, and if you have high blood pressure, what you can do about it. Dr. McCormick is an internal medicine physician in Anchorage and is governor of the Alaska chapter of the American College of Physicians. She also volunteers at Covenant House Alaska and is a former distinguished young woman, also a title that used to be known as Junior Miss, updated to the 21st century, and now serves as a judge for distinguished young woman. So, Dr. McCormick, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Very good. So before we start talking about hypertension, a couple of months ago we had a program on millennials in the healthcare workforce, and it occurred to me as I've talked to people who listen to the show regularly how there's a lot of people who don't know how you get into healthcare as a career. So I just wanted to talk a bit about how you became an internal medicine physician and what that is. I know you were an undergraduate at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and you also did the WAMI program, the Alaska WAMI program, I assume.
Yes.
And a great way for physicians to be trained to be in Alaska. After completing your medical school, you went on to an internal medicine residency training in Spokane and then returned to Alaska, where you've practiced both inpatient in the hospital and outpatient in the clinic medicine, for initially in Juneau, and then 8 years later moved to Anchorage, where you're practicing outpatient medicine. So what is an internal medicine physician?
Good question. When I started medical school, I had no idea what internists were. And through my training, you get exposed to all the different specialties when you're going through your rotations. The internist is, or internal medicine doctors, specialize in adult medicine, whereas a family practice doctor will take care of pediatrics and obstetrics as well as adults. And that gives us the unique ability to focus on a little more complex disease processes. So we deal with the older, sicker patient more often, although we do general medicine, colds and annual physicals, preventative medicine, treatment of high blood pressure and diabetes is kind of our bread and butter.
Okay. And for listeners who might care, I'm actually also an internal medicine physician. So we have a similarity there. So taking care of, well, actually cardiology is a subspecialty of internal medicine, yes. One that's very procedurally focused. Let's start talking about some of the functions of the heart and what blood pressure is. So let's just start with that. There's a couple numbers involved. Tell us about that.
Okay, so blood pressure is the pressure inside your blood vessels, and it's a component of the heart contraction and the arterial resistance. And if I can bring up an analogy now, because I think we can use it throughout our discussion, but it's kind of like a hose. And if you turn on the faucet of the hose, that's about like your heart contracting. The more you turn it on, the higher the pressure. And the size of your hose really makes a difference. So if you have a really tiny, narrow hose, your pressure is going to be more elevated as opposed to a big, big, floppier hose. And the systolic blood pressure is going to be that top number of the readings you get, 120 over 80 now being normal. 120 is your systolic, and that's with the contraction of the heart. The diastolic is the relaxation phase of the heart and that lower number.
So that first number is the lub. The second number is during the dub, I suppose.
Yes.
Okay. So what is a normal blood pressure? One of the reasons we wanted to have this discussion is there has, over the past year, been a lot of discussion over new definitions of what is high blood pressure. In November of 2017, guidelines were issued by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association that really paint the whole picture of the best ways to identify and treat hypertension. It is a remarkable document and doorstop with 481 pages, 106 recommendations, 23 tables, 11 figures. I have to admit, I have not read it. I have read a number of summaries, and of course, that has helped me understand what some of the changes are. One of the most notable is that this guideline recommended changing the threshold for the diagnosis of hypertension from a systolic and diastolic pressure greater than 140 and 90 down to 130 over 80. How has that impacted your practice? And tell us a little more about what that means.
Yeah, well,
why that was done.
Well, in 2003, I think that was our last recommendations, and that was the 140 over 90. Now, normal is considered less than 120 over 80. You're elevated if you're 120 to 130 over 80. Stage 1 hypertension is 130 to 139 over 80 to 89, and stage 2 is above 140 over 90. And our treatment will depend on where you fall into those ranges. To be considered hypertensive, you need 2 elevated blood pressures on 2 separate occasions. And it makes a difference because what we have seen is there's been a doubling in your risk for cardiovascular disease for every 20 points higher on the systolic and every 10 points higher on the diastolic. So if you go from 120 to 140 over 90, you're going to double your risk of cardiovascular disease.
Okay. So this is a really big deal, though, because the risk is significant in terms of your risk of heart attack or stroke or kidney disease. But also just in terms of the burden on the healthcare system, because the prevalence of hypertension under the old definition was, as I said in the opening, a little bit dated, roughly 1 in 3 adults. But this gets it up to nearly half of all adults.
Correct.
So I'm sure there are many listeners out there who may have high blood pressure or may have recently been told that they have high blood pressure. So we would certainly welcome your participation here on Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Feel free to join the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. That's lineone@alaskapublic.org. And finally, if you're in the Anchorage area, our local number is 550-8433. And we're talking today with Dr. Julie McCormick, internist here in Anchorage, about high blood pressure. So there also used to be the term pre-hypertension. Is that something that's gone by the wayside, or do we just call everybody above 130 hypertensive now?
It is kind of gone by the wayside. They've now switched from pre-hypertensive to elevated. So that's your 120 to 130. And anything above that is considered hypertensive.
Okay. And we in the promo for the show, we talked about hypertension oftentimes being called the silent killer. It has no symptoms sometimes until it's really too late, when a heart attack occurs or if a stroke develops. So tell us a little more about how it is diagnosed. You made reference earlier about measuring blood pressure in the clinical situation, but what in real life, we've talked about a definition of what the numbers are that define high blood pressure. What does that mean in clinical practice? How do you assess that in a patient?
So if you're not seeing a physician, you may never get your blood pressure checked. So that's a good plug that everybody should have a primary care physician. The guidelines are to get your blood pressure checked every 2 years after the age of 18, more frequently if you have elevated blood pressure. With this new guidelines that came out last year, they do talk about specific ways to check your blood pressure. And sometimes in the physician's office, we get in a hurry and we're probably not necessarily doing it correctly all the time. But the way you should check your blood pressure is the patient should be sitting in a chair with a back and resting for about 5 minutes without talking prior to getting their blood pressure checked. They also talk about having an empty bladder, and that's news to us. And a lot of times we don't have time in the office to be thinking about all these things. The blood pressure cuff should be above the inside of the elbow, and the arm should be resting on a table or the arm of the chair while you're getting your blood pressure checked. You shouldn't be talking during the blood pressure reading either.
So right now, we probably should not check our blood pressures because a little bit of stress talking to the state of Alaska. We've been sitting for more than 5 minutes, but I've almost finished my coffee already, and so I'm not sure. I'm about to give more information than people want to hear. So what about the do-it-yourself cuffs that you see in pharmacies and different places? I actually went to a gym and saw one, and just for grins, checked my blood pressure after running.
And what was it, Jay?
It was pretty high, but my heart rate was still up, too.
So I think do-it-yourself cuffs are great. I prefer the arm cuffs over the wrist cuffs. They are very positional. So same way you would check it in the doctor's office, the good arm cuff, they need to be the appropriate size. If you have questions about the sizing of the cuff, if you have a large arm, you need a large cuff. If you put too small of a cuff on, you'll get a falsely elevated reading. But relax for 5 minutes, check those. If there is a discrepancy of what you're seeing in the office to what the readings are at home, always bring the cuff into your doctor's office to see if they're matching. But it's a good way to do some screening and good way to be kind of responsible for your own health.
Okay. Now, let's say we've done a couple measurements and it's in the 130s. Let me actually pursue a little more of this issue of the diagnosis. Back when I was in medical school, I think we were first using the term white coat hypertension, mm-hmm. recognizing that many people are somewhat stressed when they come into the clinic. You've already summarized in the new guidelines some of the ways that medicine has tried to address that by helping people to relax, to sit down for a while. What has been your experience with that? I'm curious if you've seen patients that have a couple measurements that are a little high, you start monitoring at home and you find, no, it's not consistently high, that for whatever reason, you're making them nervous, Dr. McCormick.
I know, and that does happen all the time. It's happened to me personally being in the doctor's office. So it's something that people really can't control necessarily. We try to make it a comfortable environment, and I try not to yell at my patients. So they should not be stressed when they come in. But checking their, if it's high in the office, I do have them record blood pressures at home. And the guidelines state to check it every day and just record what they're reading at home, again, in that relaxed atmosphere. And bring them in. And if there is a discrepancy between the home readings and if they're higher in the office, that is diagnosed as white coat hypertension. Does not need to be treated, but these patients are at elevated risk for long-term or developing long-term hypertension down the line.
Okay, so it could be a red flag that you want to monitor
a
little more frequently. Have you seen situations where someone, say, is monitoring at home and their blood pressure is a bit elevated, but in the clinic, not so much?
I have, and that's where I want them to bring their cuff in to see if they're reading correctly. I have seen that home cuffs not work exactly properly.
Yeah. One of the things I was actually thinking about earlier this morning, having had a fairly short night's sleep, is what happens to blood pressure at night. Does it tend to mellow out, or are there problems with, do people with high blood pressure have high blood pressure through the night?
They can. Typically, as you're resting, your blood pressure will go down. In the early morning hours, the hormones of your body start to kick in and tend to raise your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your heart rate to get you ready for the day. So a lot of times we will see the blood pressures peaking in the early morning hours.
Is that related to morning cortisol release and some of what happens with the circadian rhythm?
Exactly.
Okay. That would actually be an interesting physiological research question in Alaska, where the light dark cycles are very different. And I tell people outside, you know, I don't suffer jet lag in the middle of winter or middle of summer because I'm constantly jet lagged.
That's right.
I don't know if that's scientifically based, but just a personal observation. So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. The topic of the discussion today is high blood pressure, and I'm speaking with Dr. Julie McCormick. We welcome you to join the discussion by calling in toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at lineone@alaskapublic.org. So some people are probably at higher risk than others. You've already mentioned basically everybody needs to worry about high blood pressure. Maybe I shouldn't say worry because that would make your blood pressure go up. But that everyone is at some degree of risk and should have screening as adults. And there's specific recommendations for children also. But are there certain lifestyle factors, other things that make someone at higher risk?
Absolutely. So aging is probably one of the biggest risk factors. They say if you have a normal blood pressure at age 55, you have a 90% chance of getting high blood pressure in your lifetime. So where it's not normal, it's extremely common. So age. And we can't modify that risk factor. But things we can modify are physical inactivity, weight gain and obesity, tobacco use, and that's a stimulant, vasoconstrictor, increases the heart rate, family history, which again, we can't alter, and poor diet.
Yeah, I was going to ask about dietary factors. When we think about what we do in terms of changing lifestyles, I know sodium comes up. I have a little prop here that has a little sound. It's a snack bag. Looking at it, it has 140 milligrams of sodium, which is about 6% of your recommended daily amount. It's kind of ironic. It's branded as heart healthy. I won't say what name it is or Zakiya may be giving me dirty looks for getting potential NPR sponsors in trouble, but it, I think, does highlight how much of the 21st century diet is not heart healthy. And even some things that we call heart healthy based on maybe the fatty acid profile still can have a lot of sodium.
Right. So for the DASH diet, which is what's recommended when you have high blood pressure or the elevated blood pressure, you want to look at a diet high in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy, low saturated fat because there's that heart disease component. But the salt is kind of a big part of that diet. And I think a typical American diet it can vary so much, but well over 2,000 milligrams. The DASH diet wants to keep it under 1,500 milligrams a day. And a teaspoon of salt is about 2,300. And I don't know, Jay, but looking at that label, was that one serving size? You got to look at the serving size on your labels,
That is a very good point, because I've noticed that just in terms of looking at fat content, sometimes, that's not a lot of fat. And then I realize it says a serving size is, say, a quarter cup. And I don't know about you, but I've never eaten a quarter
exactly.
cup of anything. So you're absolutely right on that.
So a can of chicken noodle soup, 2,000 milligrams in one can. Prepared foods have a lot of sodium, and that can of chicken noodle soup is actually, the whole can is 2,000, but it's meant to be two servings.
Yeah. Great. Well, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to take a brief break for the stations down the line, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. Our topic of discussion is hypertension or high blood pressure. My guest is Dr. Julie McCormick, internist here in Anchorage. And we've been talking about some of the risk factors for hypertension. And we were talking about the fact that aging is a risk factor, that the risk of high blood pressure goes up with aging, and that is one that is not modifiable. The alternative to aging is not very attractive either, so I'll take the aging. Family history, also not one that necessarily can be modified, but there are other things such as increased physical activity, dietary factors, avoiding tobacco use as well. So one of the things that really has impressed me in following some of the literature on hypertension is how profound the impact of diet can be. In the guidelines, as you mentioned, the DASH diet, which stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, you know, the diet can bring the systolic blood pressure down as much as 10 to 11 millimeters. And that is pretty significant, particularly when we start talking about a lower threshold of diagnosis, that approaching even the old definition can really begin to make an impact. And I want to talk some more about those risk factors, but I'd like to take a call first.
Sure.
So, Betty, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Do you have a question for Dr. McCormick?
I sure do. My husband went through a testicular cancer treatment several years ago, and after several rounds of chemotherapy and some very intense surgeries, he developed really high blood pressure that was causing him a lot of pain and was subsequently put on a couple types of medication. And I was wondering if you had any advice or thoughts on something he can do, particularly because this kind of came in effect from his chemotherapy and all of the stresses that he went through for cancer treatment. He's not even 40 yet and is concerned he's going to be on this medication for the rest of his life. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, the first thing is getting his blood pressure under control is very important, especially in a younger person, because he has so long to live and the damage caused by the elevated blood pressure over a long period of time can make a profound impact down the line for him. He may end up being on high blood pressure medication for the rest of his life, but you mentioned a couple things. Pain, is he in pain? Because pain can cause high blood pressure.
He is in pain pretty frequently just from the effects from everything that he's been through. But when his blood pressure goes up, it causes him considerable pain in the head and neck area. And so he's been able to manage that pretty much. But if he misses a dose of his medication, then he is an incredible amount of pain.
Okay. Well, that can be concerning if he has pain with exertion or when his blood pressure is elevated. He may want to get that looked at and ruled out for having any heart disease. Sometimes heart disease can radiate into the jaw and the neck or into the back. So with his risk factors and prior history of chemotherapy, you know, he may want to talk specifically to the doctors about the pain. But keeping his blood pressure down sounds like it works if he's taking his medication regularly. Does he exercise? Does he eat healthy?
More and more so. It's been a very slow process recovering and being able to do that. But, yeah, we're getting there for sure.
Okay. And then stress does cause temporarily elevated blood pressure, but it doesn't look like it accounts for long-term high blood pressure. So when you're in a stressful event, temporarily you can increase your blood pressure, but that's not probably his underlying problem at this point. But he should be doing some relaxation, kind of de-stressing if he can, if he needs a counselor to deal with some of these chronic medical issues. You know, make sure he's getting good sleep, exercise, those kind of things.
Okay, awesome. I really appreciate your input.
Sure.
Thank you for joining us on Line One, Betty. So Betty raises a really important point as we talk about modifiable risk factors, is that medications can also elevate blood pressure. And you actually touched on this a little earlier when you were talking about tobacco being a stimulant, and certainly even prescription medications such as some of the ADHD medications can elevate blood pressure as well. We actually have an email question that relates to stimulants also, one that I think I hinted that I'm already participating and imbibing in as we're on the air, and that is, does caffeine raise blood pressure?
I
sincerely hope not.
Yeah, I don't think so. People could get a temporary bump in their blood pressure from caffeine, but it's not significant. They don't recommend to avoid caffeine. Now, if you have palpitations or it makes you nervous or heartburn, those things may relate more to the caffeine intake.
Okay. Another email question that I think relates well to the discussion we were having about consistency and how we make the diagnosis. This is from Mark. And he says, in keeping track of my blood pressure at home, I followed the directions, but I find that if I take it several times over 15 or so minutes, that there can be considerable differences in the readings. Sometimes it goes up and sometimes it goes down. I have two blood pressure devices, and it's the same thing with both. The variations are typically around the healthy, unhealthy boundary line. So it's right where, you know, you're trying to decide, is this good or bad? So he asks, how much faith should I put in a single reading?
I think you should be averaging your blood pressure readings over time. Your blood pressure is dynamic. It's going to change in different parts of the day. Within 5 minutes, could it change? I suppose. If you're resting, I recommend checking it after 5 minutes of rest and then a minute later and then possibly another minute and maybe not 15 minutes apart. But yeah, you should have variations in your blood pressure. If you don't, there's something wrong with your body because you want to be able to muster a higher blood pressure in a stressful situation. But averaging your blood pressures over time and seeing a gist of where you're at is more helpful than one blood pressure reading.
Yeah, and I think you touch on something that frequently impacts people, which is the postural changes in blood pressure. And I don't know, it's part of the reason why we have people sit quietly and in the same position to measure, because when we stand up, usually our heart rates go up, our blood pressure comes down some. If that's exaggerated in some people, they're maybe manifestations of lightheadedness, but that could be a challenge in the diagnostics also, I would
absolutely
think.
That's why they've made these guidelines so that you're consistent with how you take them.
Yeah. So we haven't quite yet gotten into the discussion of medications, but in thinking about the stepwise approach of lifestyle changes and medications, We have a question by email that asks, how can I help a very dear loved one who has hypertension, which runs in the family, but refuses to do anything about it? And examples are quit tobacco, make healthy eating and lifestyle choices, because they're afraid that once you go on pills, you have to take them for the rest of your life, which is one of the reasons why lifestyle choices be very, very attractive. This I suspect is a spouse, but she asks, I'm afraid of the consequences we may later face as a family as a result of his youthful choices now.
Absolutely, I would be very concerned. So if he's unwilling to make lifestyle choices, then medications can prevent stroke and heart disease, heart failure, and devastating consequences down the line. So one way or another, it should be addressed. If he doesn't want to be on medication, then getting rid of the tobacco, starting to exercise, losing weight. They say with weight loss, every 2 pounds you lose drops your blood pressure by 1 millimeter. So those changes can prevent him from going on medication. But what you don't want him to do is have a stroke 5-10 years down the line when he could have addressed it now.
So that whole issue of compliance with guidelines, whether that's lifestyle changes or medications, is a challenge. And I want to get into that a little bit in terms of what are some of your approaches for compliance. I think I wanted to just spend a second talking about a essay that was in the New England Journal of Medicine a few weeks ago by a Pakistani American describing her father's practice as an internist, and an interaction with a another Pakistani patient. And the point was that we have very Western ways in assuring compliance. And so she describes this interaction between her father and a patient, and her father saying, Khan Sahib, you must take your medication. And Mr. Khan, Dr. Sahib, what will happen if I don't? Her father, you'll become paralyzed. Mr. Khan, what will happen next? The father, your son will take your property and throw you out of the house. Mr. Khan begins laughing. Then I must take my medications. And she points out that her father, in this cultural context, never asked Mr. Khan what his values and preferences were, which would be our usual approach in Western culture, because he knew that such an approach was pointless, because Mr. Khan came from a culture where he saw the job of the doctor as telling him what to do, not asking him what outcomes he wanted and coming to a provider-patient decision aid assisted agreement. So it points out, I think, that one of the aspects of the art of medicine that we have to understand our patients, and everyone is different in terms of how they understand the risk and also how we might communicate with them. So what are some of your tools to be able to assure compliance with whether it's lifestyle or medication?
Well, that's difficult, but
which is why I read that story, because it is very, very difficult.
I feel my role is to educate the patient and let them know what will happen if we don't make the changes I'm recommending. And first of all, nobody wants to be on medication for the rest of their life, but sometimes it's necessary, and we try to discuss the importance of that. Adhering to diet and exercise, it has to be a marathon. It can't be just a sprint. So having follow-up with them, having markers that we can look at, weight, BMI, body fat percentages, blood pressures, and trying just to encourage them. But we can make small changes without having to change everything at once. And I think baby steps is very helpful. Somebody who doesn't love exercise, I don't necessarily start with telling them to exercise 30 minutes 5 days a week, but maybe starting off 5-10 minutes 3 days a week and build from there. So something that's doable for people, maybe eating out less often, trying to switch from going to fast food to something healthier choice.
Right. So here's a question from Larry, which I think touches on a number of issues. He says, I found that my blood pressure measurement with my eyes closed, in addition to not talking and not thinking about stressful things, lowers my blood pressure numbers. So I try to take my blood pressure in the morning before rising, but that is often on a full bladder, unfortunately, and after laying down to sleep several minutes after actually getting into bed. Same time every day helps find consistent numbers. So let's start. I'll get to his second part of his question in a moment, but that issue of closing the eyes, I'm actually sort of wondering if there's not a little bit of biofeedback here.
There must be relaxation and avoiding that stress right before getting a blood pressure taken. There are people that just have cuff hypertension. When they see that cuff coming, their blood pressure spikes. So that could be his way of just relaxation.
Yeah, I know biathletes oftentimes learn how to slow their heart rates down, and I don't know what happens to their blood pressure during that. At one time I was able to do that. I really freaked out a nurse once by doing it while she was measuring my pulse. But and she actually looked at me and said, "Are you doing that on purpose?" Because she somehow knew that. And I wonder if what Larry's describing is that that relaxation and maybe at some level almost an intentional winding down of his catecholamine levels very quickly so that his blood pressure is more under control. He also raises the point that he finds his blood pressure is lower after exercising and asks, is there something about opening up the blood vessels? Could you please talk about that?
Sure. So during exercise, the blood pressure should actually go up. And if you're having the opposite response, we're worried about that. But shortly after exercise, it will come back down. And that's probably a result of being warm and vasodilated, all the blood's in your muscles and not just concentrated in the blood vessels themselves. So, yeah, I'm sure it's being warm and the increased capacitance.
And then as I understand some of the chronic effects of exercises, it's sometimes called vagal tone, but there's a part of the nervous system that drives blood pressure and heart rate, and that helps bring things down as well.
Absolutely. And then your heart becomes more efficient, doesn't have to beat as hard and as often.
Okay. So let's actually talk just a little more about this issue of lifestyle changes. We've talked about weight, diet, stimulants. Now, there's a couple of stimulants that we haven't talked on. One of which is specifically called out in the guidelines, and it's not one that we really think of as a stimulant. They recommend either abstinence from or moderation in alcohol consumption. And
absolutely.
Recommend one or less drinks per day for women, or two or less for men. What is the role of alcohol in high blood pressure?
I don't know how best to answer that, Jay, but we do know that alcohol may reduce your blood pressure initially as you're relaxed, but that withdrawal effect after alcohol is removed, the heart rate, blood pressure, all tend to go up, activity in your brain, and it's just that withdrawal effect.
Okay. And of course, there are many other health reasons why alcohol should be consumed in moderation, if at all. And I always feel like I have to remind people that I think one of the public health messages that's underemphasized is the role that alcohol plays as a risk factor for breast cancer. I've heard that from a number of women who've been diagnosed with breast cancer and were not aware of that until after their diagnosis. Another issue that I know you don't have specific data on, because I've looked and it's not there. It's always interested me that after THC exposure, heart rate and blood pressure go up, but I have not been able to find any information on marijuana use as a risk factor for high blood pressure.
So. And I've looked as well, and there's just not enough data or studies out there to give somebody, you know, actual data.
All right. So you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. It's time for a break, and we'll be right back with the third period of the program today.
Funding for Line 1, your health connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm Dr. Jay Butler, your host today. With me in the studio here in Anchorage is Dr. Julie McCormick, internal medicine physician, and we're talking about hypertension, also known as high blood pressure. So we've talked about a number of ways to control blood pressure and also reduce risk for blood pressure through lifestyle interventions. Unfortunately, that does not work for everyone. So Dr. McCormick, when do you sort of decide, okay, now's the time to start medication, and what are the options? How do you decide how to treat?
Oh, yeah. So that's a very individual choice. So based on patients' comorbid conditions, other things that are going on with them, their age, their race, is how I'll choose medications. If we can go back to that hose analogy, you have the faucet which turns your hose on and or the water on, and that's the contractility of the heart. We have medications that work on relaxing the heart. So those are your beta blockers. Then you have your hose and the diameter of the hose. We have calcium channel blockers and ways to dilate those blood vessels. We have the water inside the blood vessel wall or inside the blood vessel like the water in the hose. And we have diuretics and water pills that help reduce the volume. And then you have the nozzle at the end. And I think that of the kidneys function and how they manage getting rid of the water. And that would be ACE inhibitors and ARBs. For different populations, you want to choose maybe side effects of those medications that will benefit them. If you have somebody with a lot of swelling in their legs or heart failure, you'll want to put them on a water pill to reduce the fluid in their body. African-American patients tend to respond much better to diuretics as well, and low salt diet. So that tends to work much better than something like an ACE inhibitor. ACE inhibitors are very protective in diabetics and preventing kidney disease. So that's what I'll choose for them. So depending on what's going on, we need to look at the whole patient.
So you mentioned ACE inhibitors. That's angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor, and that's part of the whole process of how the kidneys are involved in regulation of blood pressure. You also mentioned ARBs. I'm thinking that's probably an acronym.
Angiotensin receptor blocker.
Okay, so it's the same physiologic cycle, but just affecting it through a different part of the cycle and
yes,
the process.
They work very similarly, but in a step down.
Okay. So these are the drugs, ACE inhibitors are the ones that usually end in pril,
lisinopril.
And what's an example of a angiotensin receptor blocker?
That's your Losartan, Valsartan, Cozar is the brand name, those type.
Okay. So they generally end in Artin. And again,
yes,
we're talking about the generic names, not the brand name. So if you see ads, it's usually in the fine print in parentheses that you see those. But that's a way to know what type of drugs we're talking about. I'm impressed that there's a lot more opportunities nowadays for one-time treatment as opposed to back in the day when we were putting people on hydrochlorothiazide at least twice a day. Sometimes we were using medications four times a day. I don't think anybody uses Lasix as a water pill anymore, but we did a lot of things that we don't do anymore, and I think we're probably better with the medications now than before. How are they well tolerated? Are there side effects to be aware of?
Most of the time they're well tolerated, but there's always side effects when starting a medication. ACE inhibitors, 1 in 4 people will get a cough, and it's a dry tickle in the throat. And it can happen initially when you start it or years later. So it's something you have to keep in the back of your mind. The ACE inhibitors are such an excellent form of blood pressure control. I usually start with them first, but if the cough does happen, we have the alternative that ARB, the Losartan type medications, which we'll go to very often, and they don't have the cough component. I can talk about all the classes of drugs if you want. Beta blockers can cause fatigue, and kind of slow your heart rate down. So when you're exercising, you may not get that oomph that you like, but it's very protective in people who've had heart attacks or heart failure, that you're protecting the heart as well.
That cough associated with angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors is something I want to call out to any medical students who are listening, because I promise you it'll be on the board. So you heard that first on Alaska Public Media if you weren't awake during the lecture. And so a healthy life informed and passing your board. So that's what you get from Line 1, your health connection. Linda asks a very good question, because I've seen a lot of ads and get a lot of emails about this. And she asks, what about herbal remedies for controlling blood pressure?
Well, herbal remedies and supplements have not been studied like our medications have, and I don't recommend them. You don't know dose for dose kind of what you're getting, and I don't know of any real effective supplements that will affect the blood pressure that I would recommend.
So one of the challenges with particularly herbal supplements, but also some types of nutritional supplements, is it's not as tightly regulated as the pharmaceutical industry is. I'm sure we could have a whole show about the pluses and minuses of that. But the bottom line is buyer beware. And there certainly are a lot of data out there that suggest that in some of the supplements, what you purchase may not contain what is on the label, or it may be something different altogether. It's off topic for this program. I know there was a Frontline show about this a couple years ago that I think was really concerning in terms of calling attention to what some of the data were for different types of herbal supplements. So very broad response to that question. Now, here's one. Pam, thank you for your email. Pam asks about endothelial dysfunction, and I have to say she got me on that one. Okay. I don't know. Dr. McCormick, what can you say about endothelial dysfunction?
So your endothelium is the lining of your blood vessel, and when it gets inflamed, for whatever reason it is, that causes damage to the blood vessel wall, leading to plaque formation. So whether it's the high blood pressure and the pressure of the actual blood hitting the wall of the artery, kind of bombarding it, that causes endothelial dysfunction. High blood sugar can cause endothelial dysfunction, high cholesterol. So it's just the irritation of the blood vessel lining. There are some blood tests that can pick that up. You have your C-reactive protein. There's myeloperoxidase, but that kind of really goes beyond the scope. But you still want to treat it the same. You want to reduce the possibility of getting endothelial dysfunction. So everything we're talking about here with prevention, preventing high blood pressure, preventing diabetes and elevated cholesterol.
So the C-reactive protein test, or CRP, is a measure of inflammation. So that would be one way to assess that. She does ask, why do they not test for this in Alaska? And I'm not sure, because certainly CRP is a very standard test. Are there other ways to test for endothelial dysfunction?
It's very difficult. The CRP is not specific to the blood vessel lining at all. So any inflammation you have in your body can elevate that CRP, whether it's a swollen knee, a pneumonia, whatever. So you don't necessarily know what you're picking up with that. There are more specific tests that target the blood lining, the blood vessel lining, like the myeloperoxidase, but it's not standard of care to be checking for those things. And just modifying your risk factors has been shown to be more effective.
Okay. As we're talking about the different classes of medications, I don't think we talked much about the calcium channel blockers yet. So those are the drugs like diltiazem, nifedipine, amlodipine. Are those drugs that are first-line agents, or maybe later in management if something else hasn't worked?
I typically use them in combination with other medications, occasionally as a first-line agent, if depending on if patients have sensitivities to other things, but they're very effective. There's two types of calcium channel blockers, one that affects more the heart and the heart rate. So we use it in patients who may have atrial fibrillation and fast heart rates to slow them down. And then we use amlodipine more for the diagnosis of high blood pressure. Works particularly well with a diuretic, and because one of the side effects is that you get swelling in your legs. So the water pill helps counteract that, but works particularly well in our American or African American population and our elderly.
Okay. You are listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. My guest is Dr. Julie McCormick, and we're talking about high blood pressure. We may have time for one more question, and you're welcome to join in the conversation or ask your question by calling in toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, or you can drop us an email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, we've talked about lifestyle. We've talked about medications. Is there are there certain types of high blood pressure that may require surgery?
Not typically. However, that when you cannot get somebody's blood pressure under control with standard treatment, and of note, most people need more than one medication to get their blood pressure controlled. It's not unusual to have somebody on three or four blood pressure medications because, again, there's so many reasons why you can have high blood pressure, from that faucet to the hose to the nozzle, you know, that all affects the blood pressure. But when you can't control somebody, you should be looking at other causes for a secondary high blood pressure. Renal artery stenosis is one of those, where you get plaque in the arteries going to your kidneys, or they're congenitally small, so you're born with small blood vessels. In young women or in people with who have heart disease, you have to think about that. The way that they treat that is they can put stents in it just like the heart and open that up and cure the blood pressure. Pheochromocytoma, which I've never yet seen in my practice, and I've been practicing for over 20 years.
But it's something on the boards, medical students.
We always have to think about it. So somebody that has high blood pressure, fast heart rate, anxious, tremulous, sweaty, it's kind of an adrenaline-producing tumor, and it will cause high blood pressure. I've never seen it, but it can be fixed with surgery.
Yeah. I have to admit, we used to sometimes joke that it was one of those fictional diagnoses because we worked up so many patients for it. But I did train at a center. It was a referral center. So I actually saw some real pheochromocytoma cases. Yeah. And it was just like you say. I mean, people just remarkably nervous. And you look, you walk in the patient's room and you think, wow, you need to switch to decaf. But yeah. It is a rare diagnosis, but there's a very specific treatment for that. So we have a call. Diane has a call, a question about gout and blood pressure medications. Diane, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Yes, it isn't a question, it's a statement, because we found out in our family, if you have gout, you cannot take a diuretic for your blood pressure, to control your blood pressure. It works well, but it's not suitable for people with gout, so you might want to warn people about that.
Right. Excellent point, Diane.
Right. Thiazides will increase your uric acid level, and you need to be very aware of that.
And Diane also raises a bigger question of the importance of making sure, if you're seeing more than one provider, that they all know what medications you're on. So oftentimes, if you're coming into the clinic, you'll be asked to bring your medications with you. And this is exactly why, so that the provider knows that if there's a potential conflict between the medications. And of course, pharmacists play a critical role in this also. So Diane, thank you for joining us today and bringing up that important point.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only about half of Americans with high blood pressure actually have their blood pressure under control. And we've talked about some of the issues with compliance and, getting the medications right. How do you know when you've got a winning game plan?
well. When patients come in, they're tolerating their medications well, they're adhering to our lifestyle programs, and their blood pressures are under control. And if they're happy and not having side effects, and it's something that they can manage long term.
Okay. So we have only about a minute left, but here's a good question that I think relates back to that lifestyle question. As I've spent time living in Europe, where it seems like people don't talk about high blood pressure so much. In fact, Susie says that people are more concerned about low blood pressure. Why is high blood pressure less common in Europe, and why would that be?
That's a good question. I imagine the rates of obesity and our American diet with the salt intake probably have a lot to do with that.
And of course, Europe is a big continent. And if we're talking about Southern Europe and the potential role of the Mediterranean diet could certainly have an important role as well.
Although they do have higher rates of smoking.
Very good observation as well. So as we wrap up the program today, Dr. McCormick, what do you think are the take-home messages for listeners?
I think that people need to be aware that high blood pressure is a problem and it should be treated. If you have not been screened for blood pressure, go ahead and get it checked.
All right. Very good. Well, Dr. Julie McCormick, thank you for joining us today on Line One, and thank you to everyone for joining us today. Next week, co-host Prentice Pemberton will be back for a discussion on overcoming fear and hate with Dr. Subrina Smith. Zakiya McCummins produced today's program. Chris Badayak was sound engineer. Ammon Swenson edited our web content. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthful life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.